I'm Jim Plackey, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Welcome to another episode of the Fervent Few Podcast. Every few weeks, we present you with this bonus episode of the GBH Podcast, where we chat with members of our subscriber community. The Fervent Few subscribe to GBH like a magazine, making a monthly contribution via Patreon. Members join us in a forum to talk about a wide range of topics that doesn't just stop at beer. And every week, we pick one of these topics and present the community's answers to readers in the form of an article posted to Good Beer Hunting. You can find out more information by visiting patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. On this episode, we talk to Tyler Jackson of Chicago's Present Tense Fine Ales, a brewery that wants to serve beer exclusively on cask. Then we talk to Carla Jeanwater, prolific beer writer and tweeter, about a successful battle against a brewery that opened with a very terribly named beer. But first, Michael and I will talk about Founders Harvest Ale and the way a very minor question can become very meaningful content for GBH, and we start to think about the best beers we had in 2017.
All right, so this is La Folie Geisha.
Yep.
Grand Reserve from New Belgium.
So as I try to untangle these headphone cords, you're going to start the show? Is that what this is?
I'm rolling, Jim.
Damn. Man, I was going to wear these headphones.
There are only so many slots in a day.
Fuck it.
Where I can do things.
Fuck it. I'm done trying to untangle your headphones.
You sound fine to me.
All right.
We never move these knobs, so why wouldn't you?
I just like to hear myself. We talked about this previously. I like to hear myself back in the headphones. Oh, boy.
So this is a crazy beer. So apparently they did something like this years and years ago. And it was kind of bonkers. And it was maybe a little bit of ahead of the curve in terms of, you know, specialty or craft coffee, whatever you want to call it, kind of coming on board. And so who knows what coffee they used back then. But for uppers and downers in Seattle at the Specialty Coffee Association of America, at the time it was just America. Now it's the Specialty Coffee Association. It's universal. We did an uppers and downers pavilion full of all coffee beers. And they all had to be done with specialty coffee, obviously. So it had to be a pretty good roaster to kind of qualify. And where that line is, nobody really knows. But that was the intent. Anyway, so they made a version of this. They took La Folie and put some coffee in it from a local roaster that was really nice. I think it was an Ethiopian at the time. And they served it on nitro. And it was pretty killer, the whole beer. And they served it at uppers and downers. And people kind of lost their minds. Coffee people lost their minds. And so they got really, really excited, and then they started looking into places where they could get other coffees, and they kind of fell in love with this geisha variant, which is, I mean, you can't not fall in love with it. I mean, if there's such a thing as cheater hops, this is a cheater coffee. It's super, super rare. It's the most expensive coffee in the world by pound, is my understanding, or at least one of them. I'm sure other variants are under development now to kind of capitalize on that. But that's what they did. They put that in La Folie, and it's pretty banging.
This is pretty good. I'm afraid to drink more of it because I'm afraid that it's all going to go away. But then if it all goes away, it'll all be inside my mouth and my stomach, and I'll be happy.
It'll be a part of you forever.
Yeah.
Isn't that what Jeffrey Dahmer? That's why he eats people.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't blame him.
We should let this warm up a little bit, though, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But yeah, the coffee's a little muted right now, but it tastes fantastic.
Yeah, our friend Andrew Emerton out at New Belgium sent us this bottle as like a thank you for pushing them to be part of Uppers and Downers back then and kind of inspiring them to try this one more time.
Well, I'm honored that you opened it in my presence. It is tasty and hard to get.
I hear it's very hard to get. 3,000 bottles? Or no, 300
cases?
I heard
you say 300 cases.
That's what it was, 300 cases. So yeah, there's almost none of it, in New Belgium terms, anyway.
Yeah, right. Yeah, compared to Fat Tire, it's a little right. Harder to get.
Yeah,
I think there's a
and pricey, from what I understand, $50 a bottle or something like that. And the reason for that, obviously, is coming from the price of the coffee that went into it. I can't emphasize enough how expensive that shit is. Like at retail, it's like $25 to $30 a pound easily.
Oh, it's
higher than that.
So I was researching geisha coffee after this beer got announced. It all comes out generally around the same time, just harvested around the same time. Intelligentsia sells 7 ounces for $50.
Jesus.
I think the most interesting thing this year, though, is Modern Times got it for the first time.
Hmm.
And they were doing 2 ounce tins for $20, or might have been a little less than that, $15.
Yeah.
They sold out right away, but it was such a.
I mean, that's basically for a cup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. About. 2 cups.
Yeah.
I'd say it's about 2 cups. I think I'd do a gram of, no.
An ounce.
An ounce.
Yeah.
Gram. Yeah, I think I do about an ounce for a cup of coffee. So.
Yeah. If you're gonna spend that much money on 2 ounces, you better know exactly how much you want to use for a cup of coffee.
It's true. my mom left a coffee scoop at my house on Thanksgiving, and she was over the other day, and she was like, well, do you know where my coffee, I can't make coffee without my coffee scoop. Do you know where my coffee scoop is? And I was like, I think we might have lost our coffee scoop. And she's like, oh no. And I looked, I had in a junk drawer like 10 coffee scoops. And I was like, I have like a really nice one right here. And she goes, how are you going to know how much coffee to make? And I was like, Mom, I got a scale.
That's what I do to my toddler when he loses a pacifier. And he's like, where's my pacifier? And I'm just like, oh, it's right here. And I hand him another one and pretend it's the same.
Nah, I just was like, Mom, I weigh my coffee like a fucking professional, like a real coffee drinker.
Is this that you said it really aggressively like that to her?
It's like, get out of my house with your coffee scoop. I made her cry a little bit.
Hmm. You sound like you're not a very good child.
Probably not. I don't know. You'd have to ask my mom. Maybe we'll have my mom on the show. She was here for the bottle share.
That's right. I've actually met her.
Mm-hmm.
She seemed perfectly nice.
She's fine.
I mean, she came to a bottle share.
Yeah. Well, she's come to all of them. Hmm. I think because
originally... Your mom seems exceptionally participatory.
Well, she doesn't drink any of it.
Hmm.
She's not I can't get my parents to...
So she's basically worried about you. That's why she comes.
Yeah. She's like, have you seen the liver doctor? Does he say everything's okay? Are you drinking too much?
Mm-hmm.
That's how it goes with me and my mom.
It's a lot of pressure.
I
could see why you would be mean to her about a coffee scoop.
Yeah, right. No.
What were you going to ask?
I said, you wrote a little thing about one of my favorite beers, Founders Harvest Ale.
Oh, I didn't know that was one of your favorite beers.
I will say this. It has diminished. I felt like it diminished in quality a little bit.
Other folks thought it went the other way.
See, I've heard that. So I gave up on it. And now I'm hearing from other people that it got a lot better, but I've skipped it the last 2 years. But that definitely, that beer, that was the first wet hop.
Hmm.
That's the first time I ever heard that, like wet hops and fresh hops and that whole thing. Like Harvest Ale, I thought fall. Like okay. I didn't think, oh, harvest like the hops, like harvest that makes the hops.
Sense. Sure.
So
I picture like an ambery kind of spicy thing.
So that beer kind of blew my mind, the first time I had it, and it was like this big bursting fruit, hoppy, bitter beer. And I was like, oh, this is fantastic, and then learned what fresh and wet hops are. But you went on, like most things, it started on Twitter.
it did not start on Twitter.
Well, you took it to Twitter.
I would say like most things, it started in a brewery or in a tap room, talking about something in a way that gets nerdy really fast. And eventually I took to Twitter to ask a question that led me to kind of cracking open this case. It was like the case of the Harvest Ale. Some old like Hardy Boys episode. So I was talking to a brewer who used to work there, and we were talking about some of the beers that they made and how that translated to how he makes beers now. And that was kind of interesting. And we talked about Harvest Ale, and my brother-in-law, who drinks with me when I go up to Grand Rapids, he's a big craft beer fan, but he's not necessarily, he's not a nerd. I wouldn't say he doesn't dig for info or anything like that, but he's always curious about stuff. And he really loves hoppy beers. And so he remarked that certain hops, he's starting to realize he likes certain hops more than others. That's where he's at now. He doesn't just like hoppy. He's like, I'm starting to narrow down into like, I think there are hops that I prefer more than others. Which of course, anybody who knows what those beers, how they're built and those profiles are built, would understand that, of course, that's true. It just takes a while to figure out the patterns. So he asked me what kind of hops are in Harvest Ale. And I said, well, I don't know. I just know they're wet hops. Let's find out. So we started asking around. And one of the brewer I was talking to, who used to work there back in the day, who's quoted in the article, I eventually convinced him that it was safe to comment based on the other things that I had learned since he told me, was that, they would fly in hops from Yakima Valley. And sometimes when they would show up, they would be pretty gross. He said they were rough enough sometimes when they would show up that the center of those boxes would be so warm they were afraid they'd ignite, which of course is something that can happen when you're shipping hops that are decomposing from the moment you pick them. That's why most hops are kilned immediately, dried, and baled to sort of stop that process as fast as possible. Wet hops, you don't do any of that. You put them in a box and put them on a plane and get them moving as fast as you can. So anyway, by the time I went onto Twitter, and asked where they came from and mentioned what I had learned, a little bit of a dialogue ensued where people were offended by the notion that these rotten hops were showing up. Eventually, founders themselves saw the thread and were perhaps similarly offended. I should say whoever runs that account, which they have a marketing and PR agency out of New York that handles their stuff. And they were, not historically informed perhaps on how that beer had been made and how it's evolved. And so they jumped into the DMs and offered to have us chat with the current brewer, Jeremy, and which of course we took them up on, and we talked to them the following Monday, and about a 30-minute conversation, got an immense amount of detail from him, including why they used to show up that way, which of course they did. They didn't necessarily always use those. They had to draw a line somewhere in every box as to which ones they didn't want to use and which ones they did, but they were all part of this shipment from Yakima for a good time. It was just fascinating to learn how a single beer like that, that we think of as one thing, evolves over time in both process and resourcing its agriculture, and then ultimately what that beer represents, which it's now, they market it as 100% Michigan hops, which it's not. He also uses some Simcoe, I think, or Amarillo, I can't remember which.
I think it was Amarillo.
Yeah, dried pellets that they get from Yakima as his bittering base, which is fine. It makes for a great beer. Challenges the marketing pretty directly, but it's sort of this evolution of a beer over time in terms of process and technique and ingredients, and then ultimately what it means to the company in the way that it brands it and markets it as a locally sort of sourced product, which all of the wet hops come from Michigan. So that's a big deal for them. That's thousands of pounds of hops. So it's pretty cool. I don't know. It was cool for that tiny conversation of my brother-in-law to say, hey, what hops are in this? for me to say, let's find out. And for that to turn into one of the more interesting sort of investigative articles I've written this year, about a single beer. I was fascinated at every turn. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, and it helps me kind of unlock, why did I not like it at one point? And now hearing it's good
again. Or at least
again,
what the factor might have been.
Yeah. So that was cool to read about one of my favorite beers like that.
Cool.
It was neat.
You should tell me about your other favorite beers. Maybe we can find out how they're made.
Yeah.
This is becoming like a science show now.
It's like cereal, but figuring out how beers are made.
A six episode.
Yeah. they're from around here, right? We can get them to help us out with that. Get WBZ on the phone. Although they've already canceled one beer podcast. Oh, so. Yikes. Is this the last podcast we're going to do this year, you think? Unless we meet up that last week of December, but...
Unlikely. So it's possible we can maybe fit one in next week. We'll see.
Okay. I wanted to talk about...
That week before Christmas is always up in the air for us.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about maybe end of the year, just kind of stuff, wrap up stuff.
Let's do it.
Yeah?
You don't want to miss your chance.
What were some of your favorite beers this year?
Oh, geez, just like that.
Well, what do you...
I didn't know. I thought you were gonna go on and on about what your year was like. I didn't know you were just going to hit me with a question. Oh, what's your favorite beer?
No, I don't know. What are some of your favorite beers you had this year?
Oh, boy. I thought that Notch Brewing was one of my favorite visits. The beers he's making there was my first time drinking any of his beers, all session beers. That was really instructive for me on how wide a portfolio can get under what seems to be a really small niche. He even had, and I think, and what made me think of it is, I think one of my favorite beers this year was this sort of New England IPA hybrid style. It was still a session beer for him. It was still really low ABV. And it had a little bit of, I wouldn't call it Trillium style, New England style. It was more hazy and kind of glowing and a little bit, you could say it was juicy. That beer was pretty kick-ass. And that, for me, that was the first time I had tasted sort of what I would call now as sort of like a hybrid of that style. I've since had maybe a dozen that are kind of in that vein. And I feel like that's maybe where that entire category is going. And I'm really interested in that. I think there will always be people who produce the New England IPAs that, Trillium and Treehouse are doing. I think that's a very distinctive style now. But I'm starting to see the next branch on the evolutionary tree, which is coming back to the middle a little bit, maybe. I think that's pretty cool. I thought that was awesome. Man, I had a bunch of beers in London this year that were all brand new to me because I hadn't been in London in years. The one was from The Colonel. I think they called it a pale ale, but it reminded me so much of Off Colors beers here in Chicago, where they'll have a hop presence, but it's not necessarily about the hops. It's all in balance with like the water chemistry and a very sort of light malt profile. It reminded me of a really balanced pale table beer. And that was one of my favorite beers of that entire visit by far. We had that at this historical pub. I can't remember what it was now. I'm terrible at remembering stuff like that. But anyway, it was a killer beer, and it gave me a real indication of what the Colonel, you know, is kind of all about from a brewing perspective. That was really, really memorable. Let's see, where else have I been this year?
You were in Denver.
Yep.
Okay. Grand Rapids.
Grand Rapids a bunch. That continues to be okay as a beer town. I'm not thrilled with most of it, but at Gray Line, which is a new brewery to me, I think I had some really technically fantastic beers. The brewer there he started at Founders, went to Perrin, and now he's on his own. He has a beer, I can't remember what he calls it, but it's essentially his Bud Light, Budweiser sort of clone in a way. I think there's corn and rice in that lager, and it was fantastically made, like just super clean in the finish. It was everything you want from like a yellow fizzy beer to just be light and sort of sessionable. I thought that was a great beer. I thought that was a really interesting sort of thing to be doing in Grand Rapids, where, you know, for all of its lauded kind of beer city, beer town USA credentials, I think it's still a very middle of the road sort of lager drinking town, like most small cities actually are, you know, if you look at the data. And so I thought he was doing something that I haven't seen from any Michigan brewers, which is meet your customer where they're at. A lot of brewers up there, I think, tend to like to do the sort of like, I don't want to say gimmicky, but some of it certainly is, but they try and do the sort of extreme attention getting kind of profiles, because that's what gets attention. It doesn't necessarily get you feet in the door, though. So anyway, I thought that was a really great indication of where somebody in 2017 Grand Rapids Beer Town USA is still trying to crack the code. So that was pretty cool. Yeah, I'm going to try and think of others before we're done.
Okay, that's fine.
I hate that question because I feel like every time I think of one, I'm forgetting 10.
Yeah. But, well, I'm going to release a top 50 beers list again this year, which I just whittled it down to 50. I'm not done yet because I know there's still some heavy hitters that I haven't had yet, including this thing that we're drinking now. I haven't had the full Dietz Tar lineup from Revolution yet.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't had any of those this year.
I had VSOD and regular Dietz Tar, and they were both fantastic. But Rye Way to Heaven, it's funny, Rye Way to Heaven, it's a rye wine aged in bourbon barrels, and in the same week that Founders finally re-released CBS, and people were expecting this big maple syrup bomb, which it's not. It's a much more balanced beer. It's very restrained in a lot of ways. Rye Way to Heaven tastes like maple syrup with no maple actually in the beer.
Huh. How is that achieved?
I got to imagine it's some combination of the grain bill and the whatever rye barrel, I don't know, but I know that it's been mentioned. It was mentioned a bunch of times in the run up to the release of that beer that it tasted like maple, and it was just through technical brewing and blending and the barrel aging process, and I was really blown away by it. I thought CBS this year, you know, the return of CBS was really good, but so Rye Way to Heaven beer is something else.
That's cool.
I think if you see Revolution's Rye Way to Heaven, you should grab a 4-pack.
There was one that caught me this year. I don't go for the bourbon barrel aged stuff as much as I used to. But man, Odell sent a bottle of, I had to look it up because I knew I wasn't going to pronounce it right, Lugene, whiskey barrel aged Lugene. Was probably one of the most exquisite, perfectly produced bourbon barrel aged, or whiskey barrel aged, I guess in this case, beers I've ever had. I'll admit, like when beers show up from larger craft breweries like that, sort of unannounced, and I don't know what they are, they tend to kind of sit around the studio for a while until I get to them. And this one, sometimes I feel bad about that, sometimes I don't. It's just the way it goes. But I took this one home on a whim, put it in the fridge, and cracked it open one night. And it was one of those things where I was like, yeah, this will be fine. I'll try this. I'm sure it's, you know, it's good. They're a good brewer. They're a good producer. Wouldn't have expected it to be particularly exceptional in that vein, especially that style, I suppose. I'll admit I don't know that much about Odell. I don't have that, a lot of access to them.
And they just hit Chicago recently. So.
Right. Yeah. And I've always thought Chilean was a great beer. Like that's a really good malty kind of like lose yourself at a bar kind of for a while kind of beer. But yeah, I just popped up, opened my laptop, was going to do some work, took my first sip, and I was just like, whoa. And immediately had to stop and like start Googling this thing to understand a little bit more what was going on, because it was just so incredibly rich, but it finished so clean and kind of dry on the palate and just made you want more. It felt luscious in the mouth, like the texture of that beer was fantastic. I don't drink, even in this day, as developed as some of these barrel programs are, it's not very often I have one that feels as refined as that. So that was a pretty incredible beer.
I opened a bottle of Odell's Dark Theory over the weekend, which is their like dark cherry sour.
Yeah.
And I was pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I've ever had a beer from Odell's I didn't like, but I haven't had a lot that like blew me away. So yeah, for something to stand out like that, dude, it's great.
That's cool. Well, we've got a couple guests.
Yes, we do. One of them's already here.
Yeah. Do we want to talk about them first or just bring them on?
Let's bring them in. Let's all introduce them.
Let's do it.
All right. All right. So joining us sort of impromptu, pleasantly, is Tyler Jackson from Present Tense Ales.
Present Tense Fine Ale.
Fine Ale.
Which I like. I like that a lot.
Churching it up a little bit.
Well, I think there's something subtle in that name that gives you a sense of the kind of beers that you guys are interested in making, which was unique to this scene for sure.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, the whole vision for Present Tense was to bring the whole English drinking culture to Chicago. So that's exclusively cask beer. Tonight I have bottled beer, but... it's hard to transport a cask.
The flaw in the plan immediately reveals itself.
But I spent some time in England, worked at a brewery in England, and fell in love with the beer. It's really something that's not represented very prolifically in Chicago or many cities throughout America.
No, and most of the cask you do see is a very different idea of what cask beer is.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's usually... they get a hold of that cask and then they put things in it to flavor it, and that's what a cask ale is in the U.S.
Yeah,
not this sort of beautiful traditional naturally carbonated thing that you get in England.
Right. Yeah, and a cask does lend itself well to adding flavors, so I don't blame any brewery that does that. But it's an amazing thing when you get a really well done cask of just a simple bitter ale, and it's one of the most drinkable beers that you'll ever taste in your life. And that's kind of what I fell in love with when I was in England.
You were the subject of Stephanie Bicey's first piece for us, her first feature for us. This was a year and a half ago, maybe?
About 2 years ago.
Yeah. You sent me an email and told me what you were doing, and you were basically homebrewing out of the garage at the time. And and I told her to get over there and check in what these guys were going to be doing, because if somebody was going to open up an all cask beer brewery in Chicago, I kind of wanted to see it from day one. It's been a while, and I saw in your email today that it hasn't necessarily moved forward. Your partner's left and gone to Michigan. You're still at your full-time job engineering.
Yeah.
Is that right? What are some of the barriers to getting a project like that up and running that you've encountered in the last couple of years?
I had a pretty grandiose vision for the brewery from the beginning. So the only way that that vision was gonna come to fruition was to get a lot of money behind it. So I really went on a mission of trying to get investors on board, and trying to explain to an investor that's not really well-versed in beer or let alone cask beer. It was a big challenge to convince them that a brewery exclusively focused on English beer and cask beer was going to work in Chicago.
Were there any benchmarks in the U.S. you were able to point to as examples of that were kind of in the vein of what you wanted to accomplish?
Yeah, there are a couple in L.A. now that are doing basically 100% cask. And then there's one in Denver that does, they do 50-50 cask and keg beer, but all English style beers.
Is that Hogshead? Is that what that's called?
Yeah. So there is a precedence for it. But I think those two breweries started off on their own. They didn't really get a bunch of investors behind them. I didn't have the money behind me to get it off the ground, so I'm still looking for the money to to get it off the ground.
Heads up to all listeners. Yeah. That is a tricky thing. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the story that I'm going to talk about Notch Brewing just one more time.
Maybe twice.
When Chris Lowering was describing how he wanted to get going on just session beer. He essentially got no bites from investors. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just a ridiculous pitch. Other brewers told him it was a terrible idea. And then he just convinced them to let him utilize some of the capacity in their system to like get the beer made, get it in the market, get people interested in it. And it just took a long time.
Yeah.
And he just this year opened up his tap room for the first time. Mm-hmm. Now I think he definitely has investors. One of the co-founders of Elysian Brewing is an investor in that project now. Mm-hmm. So he's definitely got investors now, but he was, I don't know, 5 years ahead of the curve on that. Mm. And it just took a while for people to start looking his way.
Yeah.
So I can totally sympathize with the position you're in.
Yeah, I think timing was also an issue. My thinking behind it was that it was kind of at the peak of craft beer and people's acceptance of it, and entering the market in Chicago as a brewery focused on one particular thing, and that thing being cask beer, I was thinking it would really set us apart and we could ride the wave of craft beer in general, but set us ourselves apart from everyone else pretty easily. But I think the industry's kind of gone in a different direction where it's even more difficult than it used to be to open a brewery. Even though it's incredibly successful industry, it's maybe saturated. And we've faced a little bit with investors.
I've always said that the barrier to entry remains really low, but the barrier to succeeding or competing is very, very high. That keeps getting higher and higher.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What'd you bring us to drink tonight?
I brought a barley wine.
All right.
It's life.
Yeah, it was brewed about 6 months ago. It's been aging and mellowing out in a cask. Just pretty high ABV, 10.8, but it seems to mellow out pretty well.
Yeah, as malt forward as this is, it's really on the toasty end, which is really attractive.
Yeah.
What's the grain bill on this?
It's Maris Otter, Crystal 50, and quite a bit of Black Patent.
Okay.
So that's the roasted character you're getting. I had a bottle. I did quite a bit of research developing this beer, and one barley wine that stuck out to me was Victory's Old Horizontal, and that was pretty dark, roasty barley wine. So kind of try to mimic that, as well as adding a little more traditional English characteristics to it.
Cool. Thanks for bringing it by. It's delicious.
Glad you like it.
Yeah, and it's out of sync in a good way, I would say, with where barley wines are kind of going right now. I think in the U.S. drinking scene, this is sort of obviously zigging while others zag, perhaps back towards your English roots, and so it seems to pay that off pretty well.
Nice.
I was like, oh man, there's no hops. I was like, oh wait, there's no, oh, it's not hoppy. Oh wait, I like this.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. So what do you think, what does the future hold for you guys? You must still be brewing out of that garage.
Yeah, well, I'm still in the garage. I'm definitely had to go back to the drawing boards, losing my business partner and not really getting much progress. I'm kind of like what you're talking about, Notch, looking for space where I can maybe tenant brew, or even just do some really small operation that I can get a licensed facility and just very slowly and gradually get cask out and get some some reception to it.
And yeah, it seems like following. It wouldn't take a lot of volume within cask to kind of get noticed for doing it in this town.
Yeah.
I mean, a cask beer being consistently on at just a few places from one brewery would be kind of a big statement.
Yeah.
You were doing sort of an internship somewhere?
Yeah.
Low res,
yeah.
Yeah, how'd that go?
It went well. They opened up about a year ago, and I got on board with them just after they started brewing. So it was a really good experience to see what it's actually taking to open a brewery
yeah.
and to get it going. But they're two really good guys down there, and Kevin and Dave, and they've always been willing to help me out and answer any questions I have. So it was a really beneficial experience.
Yeah, I bet. Well, it seems like even though maybe the vision's not happening at the pace that you would like, it seems like you're still working to put the pieces in place one at a time.
Yeah, so it's still a dream.
I'll
stick to it until I
as long as bottles keep showing up here, I'm happy.
All right.
Well, thanks so much.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
But tell us about yourself.
So I've been writing about beer in one form or the other since about 2007. It is not my day job. My day job, I do kind of education and outreach work for some NASA earth science stuff. So I do. So that's why I'm interested in the meteor shower, vis-a-vis that. But I'm always just been a huge science geek. So when the love of writing found the love of beer, that's how I kind of got into the beer community. But, you know, I've been kind of kicking around. I used to write about everything. Now, you know, I mostly write about what's going on in Maine because I couldn't even keep up with New England, let alone, you know, the rest of the nation's beer scene as it grew over all those years. So Maine's got about 100-ish breweries as of today. I say ish because they literally open, you know, every week or so.
Mm-hmm.
In general, you know, I've been writing a lot, and I have been just kind of engaging in Twitter because it's become my jam. So it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, to say that you're prolific on Twitter is not it's not meant to sound funny. There are some people who have kind of made that a medium for themselves, and you're certainly one of them.
Yeah. And it kind of came about by, you know, just accident. I love having conversations with people and being a little bit isolated from, you know, I'm not in a big city. I'm not, you know, in a place where I'm running into people and just seeking information. It became a really neat way to engage with people all across the country about what they were excited about. And I started off by following a ton of breweries, and then I started talking to the people who were talking with those breweries, and then it just kind of grew from there. And it's a great place. I still think it's a great place to have a conversation. And it's something that, you know, I get the chance to talk to people who are into beer that, you know, live nowhere near me. We don't have the same experiences in life. And I'm always learning new things and just asking really annoying questions to everybody. So it's great.
I noticed that you say breweries just like Brian Roth does.
Oh, is that how does he say it? The same.
He says it like a news reporter. I think it's because it's a hard word. Breweries,
yeah.
Like you kind of have to like say it in a fake way to make it sound natural.
Interesting.
If you're earnest in your pronunciation, you say breweries.
Yeah,
that's exactly how he says it.
Yeah, because I'm not quite Midwest enough to do brewery, right? Like I have to put that other syllable in there.
You have to jump to like the last syllable as fast as possible.
Yeah.
Brewery.
Yeah, but I'm also not a native Mainer, so I don't have any of that accent. Anything that I have accent-wise is Syracuse. It's all Syracuse.
Oh, there you go. Jim, do you follow Carla on Twitter?
I do.
it's okay if you
are
don't.
Are you familiar with her oeuvre?
I'm familiar with the every once in a while you go, oh, that's a lot of tweets. But then you go, but it's all quality content. Man, right. This is, I should take a note from Carla's book because I'm terrible content.
No, you're like a once a day, like very funny, insightful, sometimes incisive missive. Like that seems like
I got like one of those in me a day. Like once a day I've got.
There's like one a day where I'm like, all right, here's my daily retweet of Jim Plackey. It's just sitting here waiting for me.
The days that you do that are terrible for the battery life on my phone. As soon as you retweet me, it's over for my phone because it's.
I disabled all the notifications on Twitter, especially with the stuff that I talk
about. Yeah, it's the only way to live.
No way.
Yeah,
I don't have that many followers, so.
Well, let's talk about Carla. Let's dig into the topic that I think is an obvious one to dig into, and then we'll move on from there. But so much of what you engage in the conversations that you have on Twitter around beer, especially I would say within the last, I don't know, 18 months.
Yeah.
There's been a clear theme to them, and it's an unfortunate theme, but it's one in which I think you have kind of, you have picked up the ball and run with it, and you're just willing to walk into any buzzsaw where you think the progress can be made.
Yep.
And that is with the kind of rampant sexism and misogyny in beer, you know, craft beer in general, but specifically on some of the labels that you see.
Yeah, and so I don't know when really that started, but I realized, not specifically with that topic, but I realized that because I don't work for a brewery, because I don't work for a brewery, because I don't have essentially loyalties to any of these companies, I don't work for a distributor, I'm essentially independent. You know, I am paid by a couple of publications, but I'm mostly freelance, so I don't even have to answer to them. I can ask questions that other people maybe can't that are in the industry in a different position. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, started having conversations with, you know, either women in the beer industry or just, you know, my own observations. And I started to kind of wonder out loud about certain things. And the topic that continued to come up for me was that craft beer to me was always this big reaction to big beer, right? Like it wanted to be everything that big beer wasn't, you know, it you know, kind of broke the mold and got us back to our roots. And one of the things that I felt like it rebelled against for either necessity or just coincidence was that we didn't have to have, you know, the big busted women selling the craft beer. It was all about, you know, the taste and the craftsmanship and the art, you know, the artistry of it. So, mm-hmm. So craft in general, I saw it as very welcoming, you know, when I started getting into craft beer because, you know, people are naming things after places and dogs and, you know, historical, you know, events. And it wasn't just, you know, a bunch of, you know, people playing beach volleyball trying to tell me that I should drink, you know, that particular beer just because there's women, you know, running around serving it to you. So when I see craft brewers who rely on that lazy crutch of using or trying to use sex to sell things, it just made me go, really? Like, you really? Why? So my curiosity is whether or not this is from a place of just straight up ignorance, like they have no idea that this is sexist and they just assume that's how you sell beer. Or if it's really from a place of, oh no, I'm a dude, I find this funny and I don't care what anybody else thinks, fine. Mm-hmm. So I started to ask questions, and about a year ago, I got a year and a half, no, like 18 months. I made the first kind of large splash with this is that I asked a brewery in Indiana if they would consider changing their label art, because it was literally a illustration of a zoomed in crotch. And I just mm-hmm. thought that was inappropriate. And I asked them why. And it blew up because the...
Yeah, it didn't go well.
Yeah.
Didn't go well.
So, but the thing is that the reason I ask is because I have the power to ask. And the worst thing that happens is that they do something like that. And they go, okay, you know what? Screw you. You don't know what you're talking about. Whatever. Go away. The best thing that happens is that a conversation arises. Why is it called this? Why does it have this label? What is happening here? What I really want is I just want everybody who wants to be able to participate in beer to participate in beer. And if that means that every once in a while I have to be the weird pariah that stands up on Twitter and says, hey, you know what really makes me uncomfortable is when I'm walking in a beer, you know, beer store and I'm just walking down this aisle and there's like six packs with nothing but, you know, big boobs in my face all the way down the aisle. It's telling me as a woman, this beer is not for you. I'm making this beer for you, man, to enjoy and look at the boobs and go, yeah, beer, boobs, great. I have nothing against boobs, but it's just literally telling me I don't belong there. That's not for me. It's being marketed to someone other than me or people like me. And I just think that craft should somehow surpass that, go above that. We don't need to do that. There's no reason to do that. You have a third of the market right now of, you know, beer drinkers are women. It's growing all the time. And to just kind of exclusively market or just take the easiest, laziest, most well-known path to a dude's, you know, great gaze is, to me, it's unnecessary.
I think that percentage is really important, first of all. But I also think it's dramatically underappreciated, because I would say that there's at least that many men who would not be caught dead associating with a product that looks like that.
Right.
Maybe for their own personal reasons, maybe for bigger reasons. But the net effect is the same. It's like, I'm not picking up that blonde ale.
Right. Are you kidding me? It's not for me. Right. And the thing is that, you know, when you're trying to increase the diversity and participation in any industry, so even if you're doing it, you know, you're trying to increase underrepresented groups participating in STEM science careers, you have to think about, you know, what are they seeing? What kind of images are those people who might be curious about these types of beverages or these types of careers, what are they actually seeing as being accepted behavior by that group they want to join? Hmm. If everybody around them is, you know, making jokes at their expense, you know, whether, you know, directly or indirectly, they're going to go, nope, that whole group is not for me. So the other thing that other people don't get, I think, is that when I'm calling out one particular label or I'm asking, it's because that label bleeds over into the beers that are next to it. You know, if craft
I think that's really clear. I mean, I think that's entirely clear when you see how predictable the themes and the names actually are. I mean, the blonde ale with a big busty blonde on the label is almost like an imprint. It's like it's like the catcher in the rye for a serial killer. Like, you just kind of see it everywhere.
Yeah.
And then and the other one that's been more recent and far more egregious is the title Panty Dropper, which we're seeing across so many different breweries' names and labels. And it's shocking to me how flabbergasted these breweries are when somebody calls them out on that. Like, it seems, I say it's shocking because it seems like genuine surprise sometimes. And they never saw it coming. And I don't get that. I don't know how you live in 2017 and don't understand the implications of a word or a phrase like that in association with alcohol.
Right. And I do acknowledge that there's absolutely a spectrum to this, right? Like, there is, it's not that all of these are created as equally bad. But when you're joking about, you know, getting into a woman's pants by plying her with alcohol, that's not okay. It's one of those things that, but even just going back to your comments a minute ago, yes, that blonde, you know, label is kind of unique. It's unanimous, you know, it's across all of these, you know, it's a meme essentially across these labels, but that came from macro beer. That came from, you know, the St. Pauli girl, the Bud Light, you know, volleyball tournaments. So the thing is that what I'm actually trying to say is that even if your brewery doesn't engage in that sexist marketing, someone who is new to craft beer will walk down the beer aisle and still think that craft beer is not for them. It hurts.
Yeah, that
everybody.
It's just like all beer, you know, that
it
it's
hurts
just like
everybody because even if you're doing the best, you know, you've got the coolest, awesome, best label art there is, they're not even going to make it halfway down the aisle if they think that, oh no, I'm much more comfortable over here, you know, in wine or in spirits or in, you know, malt beverages, because they're not making me feel like I don't belong.
Now, you're talking about the impression that that gives to customers, drinkers.
Yes, customers.
Being in the science field, you certainly are aware of how that affects people's job prospects as well, and the kinds of jobs they think they can that are available to them. How do you connect the dots between what you see in craft beer, which some people would probably say or have said very explicitly, "Come on, it's just beer, get over it." But you've done a good job of connecting it. That kind of mentality. I mean, it's not that beer has a sexism problem; it's that we all have a sexism problem.
Yes.
And it shows up in beer in this way. It shows up in the science fields this way. It's clearly showing up in our politics in very different ways. In your mind, what is the relationship between all of those things?
To me, it's about having a discussion about people who are other than you. Like, if your worldview is such that you can understand and you can navigate the world and you can think that there's absolutely nothing wrong with it, then there's been enough going on around you that's cushioned you from any kind of impact that you've had or industries or whatever have had around people around you that aren't like you. So what happens is that these conversations need to occur because the people who have never been bothered by this are not the targets that are being bothered by this. I want to talk to the guys who say, well, I'm not offended by this at all. Go away. It's just beer. Because I want to tell them why this should matter to them too. And I think that that's a big, bigger, broader thing. It doesn't have to have happened to you directly from that thing for us not to, you know, need to still have a conversation about this. And I think especially what you're seeing with Me Too and especially all this stuff with sexual harassment allegations is that we are getting, I say we, I can't speak for all women, but women are getting bolder about not keeping this all in for the sake of keeping a job or for the sake of, you know, not stirring the rock in the boat, not, you know, not sticking out. And I think that people, you know, people who are in these underrepresented groups are also just getting emboldened to say, no, I deserve a voice and I deserve to be listened to as well. And whether or not people are ready to respond to that, you know, I've seen varying levels of this. You know, that's to be seen. But I really do think we're moving in a direction where more voices are actually being heard. And that can only, you know, it's going to be painful. It's cognitive dissonance. If you've gone along your whole life and thought that, you know, everything is awesome, it's not all awesome for everybody. You know, it isn't. And it's just something that we have to talk about so that we can continue to kind of bring people into this wonderful world like craft beer. Like, craft beer shouldn't be gendered. It shouldn't be, you know, have a nationality to it. Everybody can enjoy a beer, you know, as long as there's no medical reason or whatever that they're not drinking. Like, why not? It's not a gendered beverage. That's what drives me nuts, is that it has nothing. It's not as if I can't, you know, anybody of any gender or sexual orientation can enjoy a beer. So why are we pretending that it isn't?
Amen. Carla, if you didn't feel obligated to talk about that all the time, which you're doing the Lord's work on, what else about what's happening in beer right now really gets you going, like really like finds sort of a similar passion for you?
You know what I'm enjoying is that I know everybody's talking about all of the, you know, variations on themes with IPAs lately, but I'm actually really enjoying, I guess in the last two-ish years, just the proliferation in general of beer styles and how many different entry points there are starting to be that are really high quality entry points. Like, for example, in Maine, we've seen, like, I'm sure there are trends nationally, we've seen a lot of different lagers coming in, but we've also seen trends like Berliner Weisse coming up and being made very well. They used to be terrible when people tried to make them. But we're also seeing people kind of experiment, push boundaries, and find more ways to bring people into craft beer. So, you know, the people who are doing the coffee stouts, the people who are doing, you know, going to historical beer styles that haven't been brewed a long time and bringing them back from the dead or just making up their own. I think the more ways that even in the periphery, accepting IPA, there are so many ways you can get into beer and you never have to become a hophead. And every time, you know, a new style or a lesser known style that isn't an IPA starts to become popular, or a brewery near me starts to brew a really good one, I get very excited because it means that when people are getting curious about craft beer, I have more ways to introduce them to this wonderful world than just the hoppiest thing that's the coolest thing right now. So that's a big deal. Here. And then the other thing that I try to talk about a little bit is that breweries also need to keep in mind that they're still a business. So I get a little, I want to help them all do better. Like, they all need to have websites. They can't just have Facebook. You know, like, I'm trying to, you know, kind of let people realize that, you know, this in the end of the day, it is a business. You are selling a product. And if you're going to sell a product and you're just going to sell that product for profit, you have to do certain things to make life easy for your customers to find you, to select you, and to want you. And if I can't tell when your tasting room's open and I have no idea how much a 4-pack costs or, you know, all these things about consumer information that you're not providing, you make it way easier for me to just pick up the next guy's beer than your own. So I'm very passionate about that type of stuff too, because it's just frustrating as even somebody writing about beer, I have to keep my own spreadsheet of all the breweries in Maine because they're literally not all collected anywhere else.
I think the idea of the taproom hours or, you know, closing on a regular basis for some private event or something like that. Yeah. I don't think there's anything that shows up on Twitter with more ire than someone who went out of their way to go to a brewery and they got there and it's closed even though it was supposed to be open, and those people are furious. That basic sort of that basic customer information communication kind of thing is it's unfortunate how lacking that is for a lot of small breweries. I sympathize because I know how many hats those people are wearing and how distracted they are by the core of their business. But I also understand from a customer perspective, like, you've got to make it easier for folks.
Right. And it can be a relatively simple thing. I think the other misconception is that, you know, that takes a whole staff person just to monitor that. It doesn't. It just takes it takes creating a simple static website, updating your hours when they change, and posting on Facebook or something if you're going to be closed unexpectedly. It's not that difficult to do. You just have to commit to doing it consistently. Yeah. You don't necessarily have to have a full-time person that's running around, like, managing all your events and whatnot if you're a tiny little one-barrel brewery. But people do need to be able to find your stuff. So you need to find out how to update your listing in Google so that when people search on Google Maps, you show up. Like, you know, these things
I went through that process myself. Yeah. And I'm going to say it's really weird.
It is. I've done it too. And it is. But again, so...
To this day, I think there's wrong information up there about Good Beer Hunting.
Yeah. I think it says it's open to the public.
Commit to a Saturday, find a millennial, sit them down and make them help you, and then just keep going. Like, you know, as a brewer, you know, it's a minimum investment in getting people in the door and hearing about you. And sure. I do agree that that process could be better, though.
Somehow Middlebrow Brewing in Chicago is listed at this address. And people come by. We get their mail once in a while. And sometimes people come by and, like, knock on the door. And they're like, is this the brewery? I'm just like, I don't know. What are you talking about? And they're like, we Googled Middlebrow and it said come here.
Oh, no.
That's how gnarly you should, all that is.
See, then they should just send you, like, free beer so that you could, like,
oh, they're lovely.
Out,
they
like,
stop by.
They should
yeah,
hand
they
out,
stop
like,
by.
You can hand out, like, a consolation beer, like, trick-or-treaters. Like, sorry, man. Here you go.
Middlebrow stops by. They're lovely folks. They know where we are. Tell us about what you're excited about in Maine right now. Where in Maine do you live, and what are you excited about?
So I live in Lisbon, Maine, which is about 40 minutes north of Portland. Live in Portland proper, but like many people, found the housing there incredibly expensive and went and bought a house in the country. So I am kind of in the center of the state, but really Portland is the center of beer and what's happening in Maine. But what I'm kind of excited about recently is that we had a little bit of a slowdown last year with the number of new breweries that were opening, but we have had a lot of kind of expansions happening, some really good stuff about the people who have been open about 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. So I'm right now drinking a Rock Harbor Brewing Company IPA, and they're up out of Booth Bay, they're up out of Rockland, Maine, which is hours away from Portland. But it's fantastic. It's readily available. And man, you know, they're brewing some fantastic stuff. But this is something that 6 months ago, I would have been hard pressed to even find down here. So they've, you know, they've expanded. They've got, you know, they're working with a canner. They're packaging their stuff more. What I'm really excited in Maine, though, is that everybody thinks of Maine as the Portland, you know, Portland is where all the IPA is. Portland's where all the, you know, awesome stuff is. It's got Allagash. It's got,
there
you
it
know,
is. The, we got the our big Allagash. Bagels. We got our Allagash mentioned. Cha-ching.
I hope that high five.
It has Allagash.
Went
it has Bissell Brothers. It has Foundation. It has the, you know, the really famous ones. But the newest breweries that have opened in the last 3 years that are kind of exciting are doing so in towns that never had a brewery before ever. Hmm. We just had one open in the capital of Maine for the first time ever, like 3 months ago.
What's the capital of Maine?
Augusta.
Augusta. You didn't know that. Don't laugh
no,
at me.
No, I laughed because I was like, I don't know what the capital of Maine is. I felt bad for myself.
And that's Kushnak Brewing. They took over this space right on Main Street, and it's just the outpouring of people who showed up to the opening in the first couple weeks there. They're just like, they poured in and literally were like shaking the hands of the owners going, thank you so much for doing this. Like, they're just so excited. So there's all these towns in Maine that even if I list them off, you wouldn't know where they were. But that community is building around that brewery.
Yeah, and there is just so much room still for breweries of a certain model, of a certain scale and ambition in certain places. Like, there is just there is a lot of country left where you can open up a successful brewery.
Yeah, that you know, that hyper-regional kind of thing where they're serving, you know, the four towns around them that have a, you know, total population of like, you know, 5 to 10K people. That's, there's so much room to do that. And I think people who are, you know, trying to develop these towns or get more businesses and jobs are beginning to see that. And they're actually trying to recruit breweries into spaces that they haven't had anything in there for years.
Yep.
You know, there is a lot of ex-mill, New England infrastructure that's just kind of hanging out, that's, you know, waiting to be taken, especially once you get outside of Portland. So that's what I'm kind of excited to see is, you know, how these communities kind of accept, invite, and kind of get transformed by these new breweries coming in.
Right on. Yeah. Carla, I think we should have you on again sometime.
That would be fun.
The next time a brewery does something real dumb, I'm going to call Carla.
And to be fair, the most recent one, the reason I pounced so hard on the most recent one was because it was literally a new brewery and they were naming one of their first beers Panty Dropper. And I just thought, if this is not a brewery that has invested, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in labels and cans, and this is an opportunity to say, hey, buddy, not cool. And so it's one of those things that, you know, as soon as I did that, they were like, oh, well, why not this one? Why not this one? I'm like, I'm asking a question one at a time. So
yeah,
that's all there is to it. But yeah, I'm happy to talk about any of that or Maine or more.
Well, they changed that one too.
Yeah,
it was effective.
Yep. That was the first one that I ever got changed in less than a year. So the first one took a year. The second one took 24 hours. So that's
well, there's so many more. So
yeah. I won't run out.
Thank you so much, Carla. I really enjoyed the chat.
Absolutely.
And
cheers,
thanks
guys.
Again for joining the Fervent Few. We really appreciate having you in there.
Sure, yeah. Looking forward to more conversations.
You bet. Take care.
Take care.
Thanks to the members of the Fervent Few whose subscriptions directly fund GBH's content. If you'd like to support GBH, we use Patreon as a way that our readers and listeners can subscribe with a monthly contribution, just like subscribing to a magazine. If you want to join, visit patreon.com/goodbeerhunting or click on the link on our show notes. And Guinness, for their underwriting contributions. If you'd like to inquire about underwriting support for GBH, get in touch via the website or email underwriting@goodbeerhunting.com. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal. Have a great week.